Come on out, James. Well, good morning to everyone. Everybody got their Christmas shopping done? No, I heard a no, so that's a problem. We went out to Chick-fil-A in Apex yesterday to celebrate Jesus' birth. Of course, we would go to Apex, right? Or to Chick-fil-A. But we went there, and I was amazed. Chick-fil-A wasn't that busy. But then as we left there in Beaver Creek in Apex, we saw everybody going to Target. And it was unbelievable, the crowds out there. So I thank God for Amazon and online shopping in my life. I don't know about you guys. But this is a time of year here in Cary. We usually have a lot of people leave, and we have a lot of people come here. So I know we have some visitors, and we're so glad to have you. See some old familiar faces around here. Very glad to see everybody and to be able to fellowship, to worship, and to study God's Word together. So this quarter, we're studying the Sermon on the Mount. You know, if you'd asked me a few years ago, what's the most difficult thing to teach? I would have said the writings of Paul are the most difficult thing to teach. Having taught from Matthew a couple times now, I've totally changed my answer. Teaching what Jesus writes and what Jesus says is difficult, because the things Jesus says challenge us at their core, at our core. And it's such a powerful message that he brings us here in the Sermon on the Mount. So before we get started, I ask Christian Smith if he would lead us in a prayer. So last week, Ozzy taught, and we talked about the Beatitudes. And I wanted to go back and read the Beatitudes again before we start our study this morning, just because it sets the stage for them. So if you will, turn over to Matthew chapter 5. We're going to stay there most of the morning. Matthew chapter 5. Jesus says this: "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Jesus' message here sounds so backwards, doesn't it? He takes all these people who we look at and say they're downtrodden. We pity them. And he says, no, they're the ones who have it right. The poor in spirit, those who are hungering and thirsting for righteousness, those who are pure in heart, maybe those who are peacemakers, those who, you know, aren't fighting for their rights, they're making peace. And then at the end, blessed are we when we're persecuted for righteousness' sake. That's one of those things I think we really need to hear as Americans today. It's easy for us in our society, it's easy for me anyway, maybe not for you, but to kind of take on a victim complex and, well, the world's set against me. Well, brothers and sisters, the world's always been set against us and it always will be set against us. Why does the world hate us? Because it hated him first. Those are the words of our Savior. And we don't need to be surprised by it and we don't need to be shocked by it. We need to instead remember that we're blessed. And Jesus calls us to rejoice. Jesus' message is different. He doesn't teach like the Pharisees teach here. And Jesus wants us to be different. He wants us to be different like he's talking about here. Not just to be different, but it's because he's different. He wants us to be like us. So, I just can't help myself. I'm a nerd for geography and history like this. We haven't talked yet about where this mountain is. Well, surprise, surprise, like everything in the area, in the Holy Lands, we would say, no one really knows exactly where it is. There's a whole bunch of people that have ideas, but the traditional location is actually shown up here on screen. I don't know how well this picture came out. That came out pretty well. And that is the Mount of Beatitudes, is actually what it's called now. It's on the Sea of Galilee. It overlooks Capernaum to the east and Gennesaret to the west. So there you're actually seeing Capernaum, and that is the Sea of Galilee. I think it's interesting to look at this because it's, maybe you're like me, when you read Scripture, you always think of the desert. I think about Jesus being on this kind of desert hill overlooking not much green. That's not what this area is like at all. It's beautiful. It's beautiful there. It's also interesting that this mountain, the tip top of the mountain, is actually 190 feet below sea level. It's not a very tall mountain. More of a hill, we would say. Remember, I went out to school in Arkansas, and I'm from the western part of the state, and they would call the Ozarks Mountains, and I would laugh at them and say, that's not a mountain, that's a hill. Well, I think we would say the same thing. This isn't really a mountain, it's a hill. But the hill sits 509 feet above the surface of the lake as well. And it's a large area. In 2000, Pope John Paul II, and that's kind of running off the bottom there, I apologize for that, they celebrated Mass there. And they made preparations and had accommodations to fit 100,000 people to be there for the Mass that Pope John Paul II was going to hold. So it's a large area, and it's an area that Jesus could have talked to a great and vast multitude. Do I think there were 100,000 people there? No, probably not. But it's a large area, and you can see why Jesus would have used that to go up on the mountain, to go up on this hill, to talk down to the people so that everybody could hear him. And here's another view looking from that church. That's a church that's up on top right there that is built. I believe that was an Orthodox church. And this is the view from the Orthodox church looking down the other way, looking west and south towards where Gennesaret would have been. And again, you see the plateau on the other side, and you see the beautiful, beautiful green valley there. It's really an amazing thing to think that Jesus picked this beautiful place to go up into to give this beautiful message. Kind of helps set the stage for me anyway. Salt and light. How much do you think about salt? Did someone say every day? Every time you eat? Okay, so what does your doctor tell you about salt, Miss Polly? He says, you stay out of that salt, right? Don't put anything else on it. Why is that? Why are we always told by our doctors not to put extra salt in our food? Because it causes high blood pressure, right? Right, so it can cause some problems. But it causes problems for us, not just because we have a little bit of salt, because everything we have already has salt in it, right? So you pick up a can of, like, a canned food or canned green beans or something like that. You look at the salt content. It's unbelievable how much salt's in that food, right? So our society, we're concerned about don't eat more salt. What was their society concerned about back then? What was salt to them? It was used as currency. Salt was so valuable, you could pay your Roman taxes in it. You could pay the tax collector in salt. Robert. Actually comes from salt, doesn't it? So it's very valuable. What about for their health? What did they use salt for? What did they need salt for? Preservatives, right? That was their preservative. They had to have it, otherwise their food spoils. They didn't have a refrigerator to go put their food in, right? They slaughtered that lamb or that cow. If they don't salt it, they have to eat it all immediately, right? So it's so very important for them for salt as well. The other thing is, you know, their food probably didn't taste very good all the time, right? And so that salt was going to help that. Well, just like it helps us. That's why we like to put salt on food, because it makes it taste better. You ever accidentally got the unsalted green bean can or the unsalted tomato can? You ever done that on accident? It's awful. It's no good. Salt makes things taste better. But yeah, besides salt for a preservative, the only way they had to preserve things was to dry them out. So you would have dried fish and dried pieces of fruit and things like that, but you couldn't dry everything. And so very important to them. We don't even think about it. Salt's free for us. You go to the restaurant, went to Chick-fil-A yesterday. We want more salt? No problem. There's packs and packs and packs of it there. Take as much as you want, right? How much do you think about light? Not until there's a power failure. Anybody lose power in the snow we had? You probably started thinking about light then. Until then, who was worried we were going to come here and it was going to be dark this morning? I wasn't worried about that. Walk in and I bet Mr. Jean's already turned the lights on for us, hasn't he? Mr. Five turned the lights on for us. Someone turned the lights on by walking over and pushing a switch. But before electricity, light was precious. You know, a couple hundred years ago, the world was revolutionized with a new form of light, whale oil. That was only 200 years ago. We were actually going out into the sea and killing whales by the thousands just for their oil so we could burn a little bit cleaner lamp in our house because it didn't stink as bad as tallow candles. 150 years ago, whale oil was put out because we found out how to make kerosene lamps. Imagine how many of you would want a kerosene lamp in your house. Well, none of us. They stink, they smoke, but it was revolutionary. 100 years ago, the first patents for incandescent light bulbs were filed. And we can't even buy those anymore. We have to buy the LED light bulbs, right? So you think about that. It's only been like the last 100 years or so that light has become a commodity. Before then, what did they burn for light then? What did they burn for light in the first century? Candles? Olive oil? So olive oil and the candles would have been made out of something like animal fat. So imagine, what's the other purpose of olive oil? It's to eat. You had to choose between were you going to eat or were you going to see? That was the choice they had when they looked at their olive oil. Am I going to burn it so I can see, or am I going to use it to feed my family? Light was precious. You wouldn't waste light. You wouldn't waste salt. Our problem now with light is we have too much of it, just like salt. We have light pollution. We have so much blue light, we've messed up our brains, and we have a hard time going to sleep. We have to have our tablets have to go into night mode, right? So we have redshift to keep from messing our eyes up that way. Salt and light are so very different and so very important to them. Salt made by the Dead Sea is only about a third sodium chloride. The rest of it's calcium chloride and magnesium chloride. And I found this very interesting that calcium chloride and magnesium chloride are what's called hydroscopic. So they're going to absorb moisture from the environment out of the air. But then the salt, the actual salt, the sodium chloride, which is what we use as table salt, is going to then absorb that moisture out of the magnesium chloride and the calcium chloride, and then it's going to dissolve and become unsalty. And so what would happen is they would make these great quantities of salt from marsh water and from the Dead Sea water, and they had to store them somewhere. And once they've stored them, if they stored them on the ground and in giant piles, the outside layer on the bottom, which had absorbed groundwater, and on the outside, which had absorbed moisture from the air, wasn't salty anymore. It was still salt in the way that salt is just an acid combined with a base. But it wasn't salt that you would want to use. And it wasn't salt that would taste good. It would have tasted bitter. Another way that salt was adulterated was we talked about that you could actually pay your tax to Rome in salt. How much did people like paying taxes? Well, how much do you like paying taxes? Right? No one likes paying taxes. And the Jews during this time especially didn't like paying taxes to the Romans. So what they would do is they would adulterate their salt. They'd take sand or some other form of powder and add it to their salt because you got weighed against your taxes. And the Romans knew this was going to happen, and so what they had to do was they had to put it back into water and then go back through the whole process of drying it out to get rid of that adulteration that they put in there, whether it was sand or dirt or some other substance. And so this salt from the great piles that comes on the outside and this offput that the Romans have had to take back out, something has to be done with it once they're done with it. This is trash. What are they going to do with it? It's still salt in the way that if you put it on land that's going to be used for crops, it will kill the crops and it will not let crops grow again. There's a story in history that when the Romans conquered Carthage, they actually plowed the fields under with salt. And that was a common tradition in that part of the world, that when you conquered a city and an area, if you didn't want anybody to build there again, you plow the ground with salt because nothing would grow there again. So they had to find a place to put this salt where no one ever wanted to grow anything again. And so where would they put it? They dumped it on the roads. That's where they put it at. Because they didn't want anything to grow there anyway. Nothing was ever going to grow there, and it was fine to lay it out on the roads. And so when Jesus is going to talk here in about a minute about that salt that's lost its saltiness, that's no good for anything to be trodden, this isn't something he's making up. This is something they were intimately familiar with. They would have understood exactly what he's talking about. So let's read here Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. Please read with me. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand. And it gives its light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. You are the salt of the world. Christians, you are the salt of the world. What in the world does that mean? What does that mean? We can influence the world. Does that mean we change it? Hopefully. I heard somebody else back here. We have value. Christians do have value in the world. Christians have value to the world, I would suggest. Yes, Robert. So Robert said that, you know, just like that canned green beans we talked about, that's it's nasty without that salt in it. It's not good. The world's nasty without Christians, isn't it? The world is bad without being flavored by Christians. And we can see that in the world. We can see maybe even in the last 100 years or so, societies that have tried to push out followers of Christ. It hasn't gone well. It has not gone well. You guys are right on with my notes here. The world is affected by us. How can the world be affected by us if we're not in the world? So when you put salt into a pot, do you just have a little salty clump in the pot? Nah, it spreads out, right? We know that because if anybody's ever cooked and put too much salt in something, it is too late, isn't it? You ever done that on the deviled eggs, put too much salt in the deviled eggs? Oh, it's a disaster. Because you can't take it back out. And you just spent so much time peeling those eggs, right? But the salt should go through everything. The salt should go through everything. And we should go through everything. People should look and see Christians everywhere. People should feel our influence. Yeah, Jeff? So Jeff said that, you know, in the times, and it's still today, where there's groups of Christians that seclude themselves, like monks do, for example, that's the opposite of what we see here. That's not salt. Certainly, you know, it's interesting we sing that song that our God is a mighty fortress. But God didn't make us a fortress. What did God make us? We're an army. What good does an army do sitting in the fortress? None. The army has to leave the fortress. There is a time and a place to retreat and gain strength, but that time to retreat and gain strength has to end and to go out into the world because we are an army. And we do make the world better. Or we should. Yes, sir, Ken. So if you couldn't hear Ken was saying that, you know, in his father's experience, that he was able to hire members of the church and people looked at them and said, they're the best workers. Can we get some more of those? You know, you ever tasted food and it just wasn't right and you couldn't quite figure out what it was? And then you added salt and went, ah, now I got it. It just needed salt. When someone comes up and asks, what makes you different? And the answer is, let me tell you about Jesus. What a great opportunity that is. And that's the kind of difference that we should be making. Leslie, do you have something to add? Yeah, so Leslie was talking about, you know, not quite that some traditions have put people aside, and those people become special people. We don't have special salt and then regular salt. We just have salt. We're a priesthood of believers. Ozzy?
Yeah. Okay.
the original Ozzy. You can hear Ozzy. Ozzy said that, you know, we got to be mindful that we can lose our value if we lose our saltiness. Yes, Floyd. Yes, if you couldn't hear Floyd was kind of likening meekness to salt, right? In that the meekness, meek people aren't generally something that you go, wow, that guy's super meek, right? But once you know them and you see the effects that person has around their world, That is that saltiness. Yes, sir, James. So if you couldn't hear James was saying that it's so important the way we speak, and that's one of the ways that we can, you know, be that salt, is we're different, right? And we can't beat people up. Peter says that we're to set apart Christ as Lord in our hearts, and to always be ready to give a reason for the hope that we have, but to do so with what? Gentleness and respect. Gentleness and respect. When we do that, we look different than the world, don't we? The world pickets each other, and the world yells and screams at each other. The world gets in fights about stuff. Christians are peacemakers. Then we're sons of God. Now, Ozzie, coming back to what you said, if we're just like the world, if you drop us in the world and we don't make the world taste different, we don't change the flavor of the world, we're no longer useful to God. And that is a strong statement. That is a strong statement, Jesus says, that you, Christian, are worthless to God in His work. If you're the same as the world, we're not supposed to be conformed to the world. We're supposed to be transformed. Transformed into what? The image of Christ. The image of Christ changes the world. We are the light of the world. You know, when our kids sing that song, This Little Light of Mine, this is the part they yell, right? Hide it under a bushel. No! Right? I'm not sure that's just part of the fun of that song. I think that's part of what we need to hear. Don't hide under a bushel. Don't you stick it in a monastery. Don't you leave it in a church building. Brothers and sisters, is this building our bushel? It better not be. We better not hide our light under this bushel. That's not what Jesus wants for us. Jesus wants for the world to see our light. We're a city on a hill. Yes, Bill. So Bill mentioned one of the seven churches of Asia there in Revelation that Jesus says He's going to spew them out because they were lukewarm. We can't be that. We can't be that. And that's kind of the image of that body of Christ that's got its light hidden. It's not sharing. It's not sharing. I ran across a quote from Marshall Keeble while I was studying for this lesson. He said that the Bible never told you to make your light shine. It says to let your light shine. And maybe that's a little bit of a difference. I think it speaks volumes in the way that Jesus really does say it. He doesn't say to walk around and shine your light at everybody. Hey, here's my light. Hey, look at my light. Right? Because we see that later on in Matthew chapter 6. Not to steal from later in our lessons here, Ozzie. But in Matthew chapter 6, Jesus is going to say, when you give to the poor, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Because if you do your deeds to be seen by men, you're going to get your reward from men. But we don't want our reward from men, do we? We want our reward from God. And that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus isn't saying, announce with trumpets when you give money. That's letting your light shine. No. That's making your light shine. That's walking around with your flashlight and waving at everybody else's face. It's more, I think, what Ken was saying, that is his dad had happened with his employees, is that these people are the best employees. There's something special about these Christian people. What is different about them? That's letting our light shine. And when those questions are asked of us, we need to have those answers ready. That is letting our light shine. Yes, sir. So Leslie said we have to work to make sure that our light doesn't shine. Yeah, you have to work to it, yeah. So that's interesting. You ever been having a conversation maybe at work about something spiritual, about the Bible, and someone else walked into the room and you changed the subject real quick? Anyone ever done that? I've done that. Why did I do that? I don't know. But as I was thinking about this lesson, I thought maybe that's me putting my light under a bushel. Why can't I continue that conversation? If I'm having a respectful conversation with someone at work and another person comes in, why can't I keep that conversation going? Maybe I'm afraid of what they're going to think about me. Maybe I'm afraid of being rejected. Yeah, Ozzy. Is the gospel offensive? By its very nature, it's offensive. You read the gospel and it says you're a sinner and you need a savior. We don't need to ever escape that, nor can we. So when people say, hey, the Bible is offensive, when you're in a dark room, and Ozzy, you talked about this a couple weeks ago, when you're in a dark room and there's a bright light, what do? You blink, you turn away because you're not ready for it. The gospel, by its very nature, has to offend so that it can save. It has to. So we have to be mindful of that, don't we? But it's hard to put ourselves in that mindset to know, I have to offend somebody, because we don't want to, because we want to live peaceably with men, and we're commanded to do that, but we have to be able to give that reason with gentleness and respect. Go ahead, Robert. The flip side of that is who do they reject? We are So if you couldn't hear, Robert was saying that, it's God that's working. And it's his message. Likewise, when they reject it, they're not rejecting us. They're rejecting God. And we need to be mindful of that. Yes, James. That's a good point, James. James said that, just because you decide to stop a conversation doesn't necessarily mean that, you're doing something wrong. And that's true. To evangelize to people, we need to know people and to know where they're at. So, yeah, that's true. I would say for my part, though, the example I gave, I've done it for, I think, because I was scared. Not necessarily because. So we need to be mindful that there is a right time and there's a right place. I want to try to finish the next four verses before we're done. I know we only have a few minutes this morning, but I think we can get through this. Matthew chapter 5, verse 17 through 20. Jesus continues, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away, not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Jesus is early on in his ministry, and he needs to explain to the Jews that he's talking to his relationship to the law. He's not coming to upend the system. He's coming to fulfill God's purpose. And that's very important for these people to know, that he's not coming to say, ignore Moses. He's coming to say, Moses was pointing to me. He's not coming to say the law is invalid. He's saying the law led you to me. And that's so very important for the Jews to hear. And he also says that nothing is removed from the law until all is accomplished. So when does this happen? There's a couple different, Jesus isn't very explicit here. He's either talking about when heaven or earth disappear or when the law is fulfilled. So if he's talking about when heaven and earth disappear, what the commentators go back and do is they say, well, what this is that Jesus is talking about the three different kinds of Jewish law. There was moral law, there was ceremonial law, and there was legal law, like their physical legal system for how they had set up government and punishment. And the people who hold to that interpretation say, well, Jesus is talking about the moral law doesn't disappear, but obviously the ceremonial law disappears. Otherwise, we would need an altar up here and some Levites and a whole lot of blood this morning, and we're not doing that, right? Well, actually, we wouldn't need it today. We wouldn't be here on Sunday. We'd be here on Saturday because that's part of the ceremonial law. I tend to think that it's when the law is fulfilled. And that law is fulfilled at Christ's death, there at Calvary. And so I think that what he's saying here is that the Old Testament is in full force and effect until his ministry is complete. But he's very clear at this point in time, and I contend that this extends today, that we can't loosen or lessen or relax God's commandments. Why do we want to do this? Why do we want to take what God said tweak it a little bit. To conform to the world. Maybe we think we know better too, don't we? We ever do that to our parents? We try to tweak their rules because we knew better? Anybody ever have their kids try to do that to them? We do that. But what happens when we start to tweak God's word? Try to twist it a little bit. What happens, Bill? We make ourselves God. We are certainly not. I think, on top of that, that's arrogance, right? That's showing arrogance before God. But it also means that we have lost our solid ground to stand on, haven't we? If we start tweaking one part, what's to say we can't tweak the rest? And then when we have a disagreement, where do we go to rectify that disagreement if it's just an opinion? The Pharisees' view of righteousness was very rooted in that physical obedience, wasn't it? Making sure that you didn't even get close to breaking anything. Making sure that everybody saw the things that were right. But how do we view righteousness? Is it biblical knowledge? Is it physical obedience? If we're talking about physical obedience, we have a hard row to hoe to beat those Pharisees. We really do. So how can our righteousness exceed that of the Pharisees? We're going to end here on this slide. But how can our righteousness exceed that of the Pharisees? And we have to avoid the hypocrisy that the Pharisees had. Absolutely. I know that was a second bell there, and if you'll just bear with me for 1 minute. I think as we read the gospel accounts, it's clear what the Pharisees were missing wasn't in their physical obedience, and it wasn't in their knowledge, it was in their hearts. They didn't love, and they didn't love mercy. It is an amazing thing when Paul says these three remain, faith, hope, and love. And the greatest is love. Christian, your faith is not as great as your love. Let that sink in. That's how we exceed the righteousness of the Pharisees. By having a pure heart. Our love has to be greater than faith. Paul says it is. Paul says that's the way it's supposed to work. How do people know that we're Jesus' disciples? By our love. We got all kinds of rules we want to test. What do they call themselves? What do they teach on this? What do they teach on that? Jesus gives us the test. Not that doctrine isn't important. I think the problem is sometimes we want to major in doctrine and minor in love. Or maybe you want to major in love and minor in doctrine. But it can't be that way. They both have to work together. Paul says, if we know everything, if we can do everything, if we give everything, and we don't have love, we're nothing. It was a waste of time. You might as well have enjoyed yourself and slept in. We need that love. That's what the Pharisees were missing. That's the way our righteousness can exceed that of the Pharisees. So thank you very much for your comments and attention. If you want to get ahead, next week we're going to study Jesus. He's going to begin many of these sayings where he says, you've heard it said, but I tell you. And it's a very important structure he's going to use for a good chunk of the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. And next week, we're going to go through his antitheses on anger, on lust, and on divorce. Thank you guys very much for your time and attention.